As I said at the beginning of the service, today is the last Sunday in what we in our part of the Christian church call the season of Epiphany. The word Epiphany, you'll remember, refers to some sudden realization. It's having a fresh awareness, experiencing kind of an exceptional leap in understanding. An epiphany is a wow or an aha moment, and therefore it can be quite exhilarating. It can give you a bit of a high. In the church, epiphany is usually a reference to a manifestation of the divine, a kind of a peek at the heavenly, and we celebrate a festival, a particular day called Epiphany on January 6th each year, and we remember on that day Jesus Christ being revealed to the Magi, sometimes called the wise men, and they serve as representatives of the Gentiles, of non-Jews. So Epiphany is a day on which we celebrate Jesus coming to and for the whole world. As I said, in our part of the church, we call the weeks after January 6th the season of Epiphany. Not all churches do. But this includes a commemoration of Jesus' baptism that usually occurs on the first Sunday after Epiphany. And sometimes we will hear about Jesus' first miracle at the wedding in Cana. And during these weeks, there are frequent mentions of light. It's referenced quite regularly in our readings. And the biblical texts, they tend to have something of a mission theme to them. Today, on our last Sunday of the season, a few days before the beginning of Lent, we conclude the season by listening to one of the biblical readings on the episode called the Transfiguration of Jesus. Transfiguration being a rather exotic term we use to describe a mysterious and sometimes glorious change in appearance, which some of you may have noticed connects rather well to Jesus' baptism right at the beginning of the season. We hear the same divine voice on both occasions saying, "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased." So they tie together and they kind of bookend the season of Epiphany. Now, if you and I were actually there with Peter, James, and John, I would have no doubt that we would be fairly emphatic in declaring that the Transfiguration was surely an epiphany, that we were truly seeing some fresh manifestation of God. And that's exactly why I find this to be a rather challenging text, in that the words, well, they in some ways seem to fall short of adequately describing the event. I mean, seeing and experiencing the holy, some manifestation, some display of God. Have you ever had one of those moments when you knew you were somehow in the presence of the divine? I think I have. And I've heard a good many of you describe a moment or two when you've known God to be very real. You weren't even expecting it. The whole thing surprised you. It left you kind of surprised as a kind of an accidental mystic, as the writer Patricia Pearson calls it. I've heard more than a few of you describe a moment or two when you've known God to be very real, and maybe even all too real. And I say all too real because those revelatory moments, they have the habit of being slightly unnerving. Certainly in the biblical story, when people have some sort of confrontation with God, hear the voice of God, have a vision, are visited by an angel, one of God's messengers, they're often rather overwhelmed, even afraid. There's that strong sense of awe, of being in the presence of the holy. And that causes people to take a large gulp. For example, read the call of the prophet Isaiah. It's in Isaiah chapter 6. And you will see that he is reduced to a mess when he has this vision of being in God's throne room. Like our disciples in today's Bible reading, Isaiah ends up face down on the ground. It's often an overwhelming thing to be in the presence of God. I was going to say stand in the presence of God, except standing doesn't seem like to be, it's much of an option quite often. To have a vision, to have a glimpse of the divine, it's a kind of a beyond words experience. And when we do try to describe it with words, like say John does, in sharing that cosmic experience that he underwent in the biblical book we call today Revelation, there's a sense, really, of, you know, you had to be there. Words fail us. Or as a colleague on the other side of this country shared with me and some others this morning, our words seem meager. But then words are also what we've got. That's how we communicate across time and space. Words are what God has given us. And so it's my sense that they will be enough. In today's passage, we have Matthew's account of when words fail experience of those three disciples. And we are given a word picture of a strange and profound and overwhelming event. Jesus leads his inner circles of disciples, Peter, James, and John. He leads them up a mountain. The latest scholarly guess is that it was Mount Hermon, a mountain which reaches more than 9,000 feet at its highest elevation. So you just need to add another third to our Mount Arrowsmith, which is just under 6,000 feet, and you'll have an idea of how high it is. You got to know the view's impressive from the top of Mount Hermon. But whether it is Mount Hermon or Mount Tabor or some other mountain, who knows? What we do know from our reading through of the Old Testament is that important stuff happens on hilltops. For example, that's where Moses heads up to talk to God and get the commandments, right? It seems that for some reason, the divine seems to be more accessible when you're up high. So, the four of them go up away. We don't know if they go to the top or not, but they go up away, and then it happens. Now, what it happens to be is a bit mysterious, a bit otherworldly. But Matthew describes Jesus' appearance changing. Matthew says, his face shone like the sun, and his clothes, they become as this brilliant white. Moreover, he's suddenly in conversation with two of the greatest figures in the Hebrew Scriptures, Moses and Elijah. How the disciples are able to recognize them as Moses and Elijah is a rather interesting question to ponder. But they do. And Peter, who always seems to be prepared to take the lead, for better or for worse, Peter rather wildly announces that they should put up tents, portable tabernacles, one for each of them, one for Jesus, one for Moses, one for Elijah. And then they find themselves immersed in a bright cloud, surely a manifestation of the Shekinah glory of God. And then there's this same voice heard at Jesus' baptism saying the same thing. This is my son. I love him. Listen to him. All of which led to our three disciples getting some carpet time, as we would say in charismatic circles. They are so overwhelmed that they are now face down. At which point the scene now shifts back to normalcy, whatever normal might be when you're traveling with the Son of God. Suddenly it's just Jesus again, and he touches the disciples and urges them to get up. And as he so often needed to do, he says to them, don't be afraid. He says that because they'd been terrified by this encounter. Then the four of them, they head down the mountain, down to continue their ministry of healing and exercising and teaching. And Jesus instructs them to keep this memory, to hold on to it, but to hold it to themselves. at least until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead, which was surely a most puzzling and sobering command to the three of them. And so that's the Transfiguration story in all its enticing weirdness and mystery. So what are we to make of it? Well, as it is with the strange and mysterious, there are all sorts of possibilities, but let me confine myself to two thoughts for our fellowship this morning. The first has to do with what we're doing right now, worshiping together, gathering with one another to declare our love for God, to lift up our thanksgivings, to offer our petitions and prayers, and to seek strength for the journey. This is a really good thing that we do. And obviously, I can't speak for you, but I know that I pretty much always come to worship with some expectation. I come here and other places of worship expecting that God's going to be doing something. That God's going to be here and somehow stuff's going to happen. I honestly have no clue what that something or what that stuff might be. Though I admit I do come with my own needs. And that if that stuff were to be addressing those needs, well, that would be mighty fine. You know, there's the need for strength, for understanding, for direction, for cleansing, for relationship, and much more. Sometimes those needs are clearly met, and other times not so much. And while I never know what's really going to happen, generally my understanding is that God's doing something, even if I don't see it. And of course I do hear reports back, week after week after week, that God is in fact active. Only rarely is it in some sort of dramatic way, you know, like the way we read about this morning, but more often than not, it's in much less intense ways, but it's still happening. Still, I can't help but think it would be wonderful to get just, you know, a little glimpse of God and God's glory. You know, just some little peek. Some moment when it was all clear. When the divine was, like, undeniable. I know that God does give those moments. I don't think it's wrong to want that, any more than it was wrong for Thomas to want to see the marks of the nails in Jesus' hands. These are things that strengthen us for our walk of discipleship. Some confirmation can carry us through the inevitable tough spells that come. But what we can't do, what we just can't do, is freeze the moment. We can't build three shelters and live there. At least not yet. One day. Nor can we force it. Our story today begins with Jesus leading the three of them up the mountain. Jesus leads them up the mountain. It was Jesus' initiative. It wasn't Peter or James or John's. We don't have a record of them demanding, you know, show us your glory today. No, Jesus was the one who decided to take them on that particular journey. We don't get to force our way into the throne room of God. It is God's prerogative. By all means, seek out God. Make yourself available. Give yourself opportunities to accompany Jesus up the mountain. But those moments will be realized, will be brought about by God's will, not our will. And while the time on the mountain will be wonderful, perhaps a touch unnerving, but wonderful, it seems we don't get to stay there. The mountaintop experience is for a purpose. It is not the destination. Again, at least not yet. So with the memory still there, Jesus takes the disciples down the mountain to work. The good news is that as we go about what is seemingly our normal life, life in the valleys as it were, we actually start to notice that Jesus is actually still with us, still quietly working alongside of us, still leading us. It's just quieter. So that's my first thought. It's Jesus who leads us to those rare mountaintop moments. We can't make them happen. Try as we might, we can just be available. And he'll also lead us down, and that's okay, because that's the way it works. We'll have lots of the heavenly one day. My second thought is that this story not only bookends back to Jesus' baptism, but it bookends the other way. It also turns our attention in the other direction. It's strangely, and I would even say paradoxically, related to and helps us understand what happens near the end of the book of Matthew. The transfiguration very much points to the crucifixion. The crucifixion story, Matthew 27. So it actually serves to prepare us for the beginning of our Lenten journey to the cross. Carol drew our attention to a book by N.T. Wright today. So let me quote biblical scholar N.T. Wright now. "Here on a mountain is Jesus revealed in glory. There on a hill outside of Jerusalem is Jesus revealed in shame. Here his clothes are shining white. There they have been stripped off, and soldiers have gambled for them. Here he is flanked by Moses and Elijah, two of Israel's greatest heroes, representing the law and the prophets. There he's flanked by two brigands, representing the level to which Israel had sunk in rebellion against God. Here a bright cloud overshadows the scene. There darkness comes upon the land. Here Peter blurts out how wonderful it all is. There he's hiding in shame after denying he even knows Jesus. Here a voice from God himself declares that this is his wonderful son. There a pagan soldier declares in surprise that this really was God's son." Wright goes on. "The mountaintop explains the hilltop. And vice versa. Perhaps we only really understand either of them when we see them side by side with the other. Learn to see the glory in the cross. Learn to see the cross in the glory. And you will have begun to bring together the laughter and the tears of the God who hides in the cloud, the God who is to be known in the strange person of Jesus himself." This Wednesday morning, we begin our journey to Good Friday, a day when, if we're paying close attention, words should fail us. For the appearances of that agony show us the truth, and yet, as it so often is with the things of God, things will not be quite what they seem. More is being played out on that cross than our meager words can describe. Indeed, if you look closely at the brutality and the horror, you may just see transfiguration. Glimpse for just a second, a mysterious change in appearance. For on that instrument of death, there will be triumph. And there will be glory. Thanks be to God. Amen.